from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point in a burgeoning scandal that stokes memories of infamous steroid use among East German Olympic athletes in decades past. U.S. federal investigators claim to have uncovered damning evidence of drug abuse among America's most elite Olympic contenders. Rather than a systematic effort by a government to cheat its way to Olympic gold, here in America, a private California company called Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative, or BALCO, allegedly conspired with athletes and coaches to do just that. BALCO owner Victor Conti Jr. has confessed to giving the designer steroid THG and other highly sophisticated and hard-to-detect drugs to 27 American athletes, including 12 Olympic-level track stars. So far, one, Kelly White, America's world sprint champion at 100 and 200 meters, has been banned from competition in Athens after admitting to using BALCO drugs. This week, four athletes, including the fastest man alive, Tim Montgomery, received letters from the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency informing them that actions are underway to bar them from competing in the Summer Olympics. Star sprinter Marion Jones also received a letter saying that she is under investigation for steroid use. It is unclear how many U.S. athletes may be disqualified before the Olympic track and field trials start next month in Sacramento. But the toll on American sport and America's sport reputation is already high. Tonight on Point, the steroid scandal in U.S. track and field and its darkening shadow over the Summer Olympics in Athens. Have you followed the revelations about steroid abuse among America's Olympic-level runners? What is going on here, and what does it mean? Are you hoping that the abusers are caught, or are you dreading the spectacle of a tarnished American team in Athens? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Sean Assell, author and senior writer for ESPN, the magazine, who has been covering the track and field steroid story. Good evening and welcome, Sean Assell.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Sean, a lot of sports fans will have been following this very closely, but many other people who will be watching the Olympics later this summer, I'm sure, have not. Can you paint the picture for us of what is unfolding here?
Sure. You know, for the last couple of years, there's been a little nutrition company out in San Francisco that's been dealing with some pretty high-profile athletes. And depending on who you listen to, that little company has either been giving those athletes perfectly legal nutritional supplements or has been part of some international doping conspiracy to get them the most select and complex designer steroids that would evade all sorts of detection. And what we see being played out here is really the first attempt to use the weight of the federal government to crack down on the sports drug underground. And what we have in the crosshairs is a San Francisco company called BALCO. Mm. And we're seeing now there was a federal raid of BALCO last September. And what we're seeing now are the documents seized in that raid being used to really leverage the hammer on some pretty high-profile athletes, the most high-profile of which is Tim Montgomery, the world's fastest man.
Now, these are drugs allegedly so sophisticated that they can scarcely be detected in traditional drug testing.
Yeah, there was a Sean Connery movie a little while ago where he was a art thief, and in the movie there was a scene where Catherine Zeta-Jones had to wiggle her way around invisible radar, and he wore glasses in which you could see these laser beams shooting in all different directions. I use that as a metaphor because that's kind of what steroid drug tests are. There are these laser beams shooting in all different directions, and usually they pick up a steroid. You have to be really, really creative to be able to evade those laser beams, and that's what this company allegedly is accused of doing, acquiring these exotic and invisible steroids and then peddling them to the highest level athletes.
Now, we should say it's not only Olympic level track and field athletes. They've raided the home of Barry Bonds' personal trainer. They've gone after football players on the Raiders.
That's right. This is a nexus of all sports. This is why this is considered both a mushrooming scandal and probably the single largest drug scandal American sports has ever seen. The reason that we're seeing so much on track and field now is clearly that the Olympic trials are coming up. They're now 5 weeks away, and there's a certain judicial process that has to unfold in order for the agency that wants to ban these athletes to try to do so.
Sean, describe some of the athletes who are now in the crosshairs and who very likely, it appears, will not compete in Athens because of this investigation in track and field. How high does this go?
Yeah, I actually would not use the word very likely.
Is that right?
I think what we're seeing now is a nascent emergence of a law enforcement apparatus in sports. And I think what we're seeing is whether this agency that we're talking about, it's called the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, whether it will be able to pass its first test. It's completely unclear. At ESPN the magazine, I wrote a story in the current issue in which I detail how Tim Montgomery, 2 years before he set the world speed record, how his career was in a shambles, and he had walked into Balco and walked out with a designer steroid called THG. It is the records of that meeting in November of 2000 that the people at USADA have seized and are using against Tim Montgomery. There are three other track stars in this current round of prosecution: Christy
right.
Gaines, Alvin Harrison, and Michelle Collins. There are questions as to whether any of them would be threats. There are certainly questions as to whether Tim Montgomery would have been a threat in this Olympics. Nonetheless, he is considered, as the world's fastest man, a high-profile scalp, and clearly somebody USADA wanted to go after.
Now, the way they're going after these athletes, because the drugs are so hard to detect, is to use the actual records of Balco that seem to indicate, or at least they're saying they believe they indicate, a lot of communication about dosing.
Yeah, in your opening, you mentioned that Victor Kani confessed to giving steroids to 27 athletes. If I can just amend that slightly, the federal prosecutors say that. He disputes that. His lab was raided. He was surrounded by men in flak jackets and guns. There was no tape taken of what he said, and so they allege that he made this confession. He completely denies it. Nonetheless, I was told that there was this meeting that occurred at which Tim Montgomery was given, these drugs. There are calendars that exist with notations of people's names. In the case of Tim Montgomery, Tim M. on one side of a calendar, and across the top, various notations of what they took on given days. And these are code notations. Mm-hmm. One is for C, the clear, a gel that you rubbed into your skin. It was supposed to give you an extra boost of testosterone, but disappear, have a very short half-life, and be able to let you slide under the radar. So the feds are using these calendars and other documents for the first time. Usually it takes a positive drug test. So we're seeing a whole new world of prosecution here.
Now, at this point, though, whether or not they can confirm this before the Olympics, and they seem to be pushing awfully hard. I mean, John Ashcroft on the Balco side has now got a 42-count indictment against four over there. Even President Bush, in his State of the Union address, in a remark that many people didn't understand at the time, was talking about cleaning up performance-enhancing drugs like steroids. I mean, the United States' reputation internationally would appear, Sean, to be on the line here.
Well, that's exactly right, Tom. For so long, the U.S. has won medals that have later been subject to taint, and you know, clearly the U.S. has a precarious international position right now. The last thing it needs to do is to have itself held up to ridicule as a preachy power that, you know, tells everybody else what to do and is then shown to have its own drug-influenced athletes winning gold. So they want to have a clean Olympics, and there's a lot of pressure to bring these cases up to a boil. What's interesting is that these cases are not, they don't have anything to do with the criminal cases that the federal government is bringing. George Bush and John Ashcroft have mentioned that they want to have taken an interest in the criminal prosecution against
right.
Victor Conti. But what we're seeing now is a sports prosecution. And so they're two different things. And frankly, Victor Conti has refused to cooperate with the feds, making this civil sports prosecution much, much harder.
But the Anti-Doping Agency has, correct me
if I'm wrong, but haven't they dipped over into the evidence that's been collected by the law enforcement agencies?
But in an amazing, in really, what it took was an amazing amount of tap dancing for them to get those records. It really took John McCain to intercede and essentially launder the records of a federal prosecution to this U.S. anti-doping agency. We've never seen anything like it. It was a remarkable bit of political muscle that was required. So what you're seeing is the government using an astonishing amount of leverage, power, muscle to bear down on these athletes. And we've been talking about track and field, but I have to tell you, the real muscle of the federal government has been leveraged in baseball. And I think you have a lot of baseball people who maybe are happy that the track and field people are in the headlines right now.
Right.
But I think we're going to see, after the Olympics, the hammer again fall on baseball. So we're looking at something that's playing out, I think, really over the next 9 months, maybe a year.
But Athens is the microscope that's right in front of us. Just take one example. Michelle Collins, 33 years old, won the World Indoor Championship into the 200-meter just last year. But according to the Anti-Doping Agency, evidence indicates that in February 2002, she started using just a cornucopia of illicit performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah, a whole medicine chest. And really, this is where you see Victor Conti, the owner of Balco, being accused of being a underground guru. I mean, everything he could throw at her. EPO, which is a blood-boosting drug that gives you more oxygen and endurance. Norbolazone, which was a designer steroid and earlier precursor of THG. And these are things that are cooked up in labs, made in China, you know, smuggled in. I mean, this is big-time stuff, code words. So what was interesting is that for those who peddle in this, they're digging up a lot of old recipes from the 50s that were made when steroids were thought to be a legitimate pharmaceutical drug before they were, you know, kind of disgraced. And all the major drug companies spent years and years and years researching them. So there are literally hundreds of recipes for designer steroids sitting on library shelves. And what you're seeing now is this drug underground bringing them back to life. It's quite an amazing story.
Even drugs for fattening cattle that athletes are now taking. Sean Hassell, stand by. It's great to have you. I want to turn now to Los Angeles, where Dr. Don Catlin joins us. He's director of the Olympic Drug Testing Lab at UCLA and the scientist who last summer first identified the steroid THG. He's a professor of molecular and medical pharmacology at UCLA, member of the International Olympic Committee. He will be in Athens for the Summer Games to advise on drug-related issues. Good evening and welcome, Don Catlin.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well. Thanks so much for being with us. We're not necessarily up to speed on all this, but we're trying to get up to speed before we all end up in Athens not knowing what's happening. How significant is the scandal that appears to be unfolding here, Dr. Catlin?
Well, it's the biggest sport-related scandal that I'm aware of in my lifetime, certainly. And I've been around for a while. It's big.
And a few people involved? A lot of people involved?
We don't really know the full depth and length of it. What makes it large are several components. One, THG itself, a designer steroid. That's part and parcel of it. There are two or three other designer-like steroids. That makes it larger than life. And there are several different kinds of sports represented. From what we know so far, there are United States Olympic Committee athletes. That's one whole class. And, of course, you know that there's a baseball connection.
Right.
And probably maybe even a National Football League connection, and maybe still other connections that we don't know about. The federal government is running there's several investigations, but they are running the major investigation, and we don't know all their plans. We only know a little bit that leaks out into the press.
And I read you saying these are not just last stringers trying to make the team. These are name athletes, champions. It's terribly disturbing.
It is disturbing, yes. These are not athletes who are trying to just step one little rung up and go from 450 to 449. Now, these are high-level athletes.
Sean Hassell, I know we only have you for another half minute before the break. Is there any way the U.S. Olympic team is going to be able to shake this off before they arrive in Athens?
Well, I mean, I think it's and by the way, I can say if you'd like me, I think it's not entirely clear that the entire Olympic team is tainted by this. I mean, I think we do see a select number. And by the way, I think we're seeing the select number of aging athletes who are hanging on. They need one more games. And I'm not entirely sure that it's fair to taint the entire
pool. Well, I'm not saying the entire, but yet here comes the event, and there stands the scandal. We'll talk more about exactly how this is likely to unfold. Sean Estelle, stand by and stay with us if you can. It's great to have you. Don Catlin, stay with us. We are talking about the doping scandal shadowing America's Athens Olympic performance. You can join the conversation. Have you followed the drip torture of revelations about steroid abuse among Americans' Olympic hopefuls? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the rising doping scandal that may shadow America's Athens Olympic performance. I'm joined tonight by Dr. Don Catlin, director of the Olympic Drug Testing Lab at UCLA and the scientist who last summer first identified the steroid THG. We'll be joined by more in a moment. You can join us as well. Are you hoping that all the abusers get caught, or are you dreading the spectacle of a tarnished American team in Athens? Why are America's top athletes, some of them, turning to these drugs? Do you believe that American athletes are more tainted than others or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now from Austin, Texas, by John Hoberman, author of Mortal Engines, The Science of Performance and Dehumanization of Sport, also of Darwin's Athletes. His upcoming book is entitled Testosterone Dreams. Good evening and welcome, John Hoberman.
Good evening.
John Hoberman, what are we in the midst of here? There's an incredible hubbub. The president's talking about it in the State of the Union address. We've got sports inquiries cheek by jowl with criminal inquiries here, and some of the biggest names in American track and field being dragged very low. We don't know how it's all going to turn out, but what's going on?
Well, as Dr. Catlin pointed out, we're in the midst of a truly mega doping scandal. The first of the modern age was the Ben Johnson scandal at the Seoul Games in 1988. The second was the great Tour de France scandal in 1998. And the Balco scandal is the third big one of the modern age. It is especially interesting, as Dr. Catlin pointed out, because it crosses whatever barrier there still is between Olympic athletes under the jurisdiction of our United States Olympic Committee and professional athletes, people who tested positive in the National Football League for THG, suspects in Major League Baseball. In that sense, this is a comprehensive sort of scandal that raises some big issues about the role of performance enhancement in the modern world. I mean, one point that is seldom mentioned is that as a society, we are increasingly pharmacologically dependent, and we're increasingly interested in various kinds of performance enhancement, including drugs and cosmetic surgeries.
Mm-hmm. And so you see this in some dimension as just an extension of what the whole society is up to.
I do, and I see it as a kind of very confused referendum on the larger role of more widespread performance enhancers in society at large. For example, look at the crossover in the case of certain hormones that serve both licit and illicit uses. If you use testosterone or the anabolic steroid derivatives or human growth hormone or erythropoietin, the blood-boosting hormone, in elite sport, then this is illicit. All of these drugs have perfectly legitimate uses in medicine, and then in the gray zone between medicine and sheer enhancement, you have pharmacological anti-aging therapies that are perfectly legal if the drugs are prescribed by a physician with a license to write prescriptions. So there is not just a clear drug underworld, and a world in which legitimate medicines are used, there are proliferating gray zones. And this is a major feature of the pharmacological landscape that we wrestle with as we wrestle with a major doping scandal like this one.
A kind of cultural confusion, as you describe it. I mean, I'm looking down the timeline of this unfolding Balco scandal. Just in May, the San Jose Mercury News reported that one of the sources for this THG and the testosterone cream was a Los Angeles anti-aging doctor who caters to Hollywood stars And now, as you say, in that realm, fine, but get it over into sports, and it's considered wrong. Don Catlin, what's your sense of this? As we speak tonight, approaching the Athens Olympics, is the United States more rife with illicit performance-enhancing drugs in the sport world than other nations? We historically liked to think of the U.S. teams as relatively clean compared to the Soviets and East Germans, maybe even the Chinese. Is that still the case, or has that been reversed?
Well, I think by the time we get to Athens in a couple of months, the United States will have a very clean team. They're being very, very thorough. They're very sensitive, and they're going to take the cleanest team they know how. If every country in the world were to bring the cleanest team available, we'd have a real clean Olympics. It would be absolutely lovely, but it's expensive. It takes time and energy and resources, and it's hard to get it all done, and it's a big world with a lot of countries.
Does the United States test as rigorously and deeply as other leading competitors, nations?
More so even than the others, I would say.
That was not always the case until recently, was it?
No, it wasn't, and that's because we have a new agency, USADA, the United States Anti-Doping Agency. Before that, it was the United States Olympic Committee itself, and there were issues there. But USADA has a degree of independence from the USOC, and they are a very strong, a very clear agency with goals and objectives, and they're really moving along, and I think they've done a remarkable job.
Sean Assell, I wish you could describe for us the whole skein of tensions right now around Marion Jones in particular, winner of 3 gold medals at the 2000 Sydney Olympics, world's top female sprinter. But she is not taking this lying down, yet she's sitting in the middle of a real complicated picture here with C.J. Hunter, her ex-husband, somehow tied into this with, of course, Tim Montgomery, not married but the father of her child, now in the crosshairs. What's going on with Marion Jones?
Yeah, I mean, Marion's got a whale of a lot of explaining to do. But here's the problem. I mean, you know, USADA has backed itself into a corner. It almost has to make a case against Marion in order to maintain its legitimacy.
This is the doping agency that hasn't gone after her with the full heavy letter yet.
Right. As a matter of fact, and you know, part of it is that, you know, she's coming out with $600 an hour lawyers, you know, firing with both barrels. They've just said that, please, release my grand jury testimony. My God, have a shred of, a shred of fairness. I mean, it's almost like they're invoking, the cries for Joseph McCarthy to stop. And so what you're seeing here is USADA really facing a threshold issue. Do they back off of Marion Jones, in which it seems like you can actually bully USADA into backing down?
She's come out and said, if they come after me, I will sue. And
right.
She's got the resources to do that. But then you've got the lawyer, Cameron Myler, for Christy Gaines, saying, if the doping agency doesn't bring a case against Marion Jones, it brings into question the credibility and authenticity of everything they intend to rely on.
Cameron saying that. I mean, she's paid to say that, and I think you could just dismiss that out of hand.
But it's the same point you're making, isn't it, in a sense?
No, I'm saying that they have made a lot of noise about Marion.
Right.
They've invited her in. They've made follow-up phone calls. They've clearly circled the wagons on her. If they had backed off of Marion and simply went aggressively after these others and had never gone after Marion, I think they could have. They could very strongly make these cases against the others, and nobody would say a word. But they've just made noises, and I think that now they have to live with their new aggressive strategy. Do I think that Marion's guilty? I have to tell you, I've gone 50-50 on this thing, and now I just simply do not know. Our sources tell us that the evidence is extremely murky.
But what an enormous name. We're talking tonight about the doping scandal swirling around America's Athens Olympic performance and the athletes who have been in line to go there, would be trying to go there, may not now end up there. You can join the conversation. How will the rest of the world now see America's Olympic team? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Few is calling from Boston. Hi, Few. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks.
I had a comment to make on the discussion as well as a sort of question. I don't know, more for Dr. Gatlin. First, my comment is this subject sort of touches fairly close to me because I was a collegiate swimmer until recently, and at the scholarship level.
Yeah.
And I wanted to point out that this performance-enhancing drugs aren't unfortunately limited to Olympic-level athletes. I have seen it quite a bit at collegiate athletes, and there seems to be a mentality, at least in swimming, that a lot of these people are taking performance-enhancing drugs because they have the belief that they know when they're going to be tested. They know that they're likely to be tested before major meets, and it's unlikely to be tested otherwise.
So they think they can game the system, and they do.
Yes, and the drugs have gotten a lot of sophistication where a lot of these things have very short half-lives. You can gain the advantages of them and then have your system clean in time for the big meet.
Exactly what's being accused here. And what's your question for Dr. Catlin?
My question is that at any large meet, the Olympics, NC2A Nationals, if you place, you're automatically tested for performing-enhancing drugs. And a lot of these drugs, as we've talked about, are unable to be detected at the time or aren't necessarily looked for.
Right.
Is there any way of keeping samples of those tests for years and as a deterrent, possibly so that later on they could be tested again, or is the drug, will it deteriorate in that sample as well?
This seems to be a very live issue, Thieu, and I thank you for raising the question. I mean, I see here, looking back in the timeline of this whole thing, we now have federal agents seizing an unidentified number of urine samples from the 2003 baseball steroid test. Don Catlin, what about it? How effective is the testing today? Can athletes still sneak through with these sophisticated drugs? And what about saving samples for months or years so that you can look back as your tests become more sophisticated themselves?
It's a great idea. It's going to be very, very expensive, but it can be done, and I believe that it should be done. There are some loopholes at the moment. There are some drugs that we are not effective at catching. There are some that we're very good at, others that we're mediocre at, and some that we're poor at. All of that has to be upgraded, and one sure way to do it is to be able to save the samples in somewhat in perpetuity. But if you do that, you've got to have some pretty good freezers, a good inventory system, and you've got to know that the drugs will be stable, so you've got to do some research. It can be done. It's a very strong deterrent, I believe, and I hope it will be done. It's being talked about today.
Are there the funds? Are there the funds there to do it, Don Catlin, or does that require more resources?
It takes more resources than are there today, I think.
Yep.
Can I add one thing? Dr. Catlin is absolutely a great man in this field, has suggested in the past, I think it should be looked at seriously, that any television network that bids on the Olympics, the IOC should make a condition of their bid that a portion of their funds be diverted into this field.
That's an interesting idea. I mean, especially, I don't know how this is going to spread, but NBC has said, just this week, that they're going to run 1,200 hours of coverage from the Athens Olympics this August. That is more than for the last five Summer Olympics combined. Los Angeles, Seoul, Barcelona, Spain, Atlanta, Sydney. They've got a big interest in this. Let's get another call. Mark is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
My point is simple. What you're doing is you're paying catch-up. And I'm a Canadian truck driver. I drive in North America wide, and I travel all over the world.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny that this is just breaking now. I mean, everybody in the world has known for a long time that the Americans are absolute experts at cheating on these tests. You have the best labs in the world, the best testing techniques in the world. Everybody else is playing catch-up with the Americans. And even if you do save these samples for 5, 10, 15 years, what good is that going to do? Say for a track star, for example, he wins the 100-meter race. He cashes in on his fame for five solid years before anybody cashes him. What difference would it make to him?
At that point, he or she has made out like a bandit, you say, with the view from across the border. Yeah, you raise a couple of good points all in one there, Mark. Let us pick it up. John Hoberman, first to this point of professionalism that's come into sport, you have said this is not just about athletes fighting for national honor anymore. It really is their job, and this is drug enhancement to help them do it and succeed.
Yeah, the commercialization of sport, the abolition of the amateur paragraph in the International Olympic Committee Charter in 1981, this creates financial incentives to dope, even runners and jumpers and shot putters and people like that. That professionalization creates incentives, and you have the category of the athlete worker. This is one of the reasons that doping blew up in the context of professional cycling in Europe. Mm-hmm. There it is, I think, clearer than anywhere else that you're dealing with a population of several hundred athlete workers, most of whom by far are not millionaires, but are basically working stiffs who are out there to keep a job, not to be street sweepers, but rather to be at least moderately celebrated professional cyclists.
And stars.
And stars if you have the talent,
right,
and in some cases the money to buy the drugs,
mm-hmm,
to get you up there. But, I mean, we need to be much more candid about recognizing the motives of these people, which leads to the whole role modeling thing, which has been heard often in the halls of Congress as this drug scandal has been.
What are you saying there, the role modeling thing?
Well, the major argument for pursuing doping as aggressively as the Justice Department has been doing over the past 6 to 8 months that one hears from Congress people is that athletes are essential social role models, and we simply cannot afford to let them get away scot-free when they are abusing drugs on television in front of the younger generation.
Are you saying we have to give up that notion? That's a pretty deeply rooted notion.
I'm saying that that notion is in very great trouble, that it is out of sync with the times, and that there are better role models out there, even if by the standards of athletic charisma, they are lagging. This drug scandal, the Mark McGuire situation,
yeah,
the criminality that is displayed week in, week out throughout our sporting year, should be convincing us by now that the standard role model function of the athlete in our society is really out of date.
Yeah, but here's the problem with that argument, is that most people who are sports fans are themselves involved in using these drugs, and it's a completely
sports
different...
fans are using THG.
Hold on a second. No,
yeah.
but they are sort of availing themselves of the menu of pharmacology that you can get at your at your GNC store in the mall.
Okay.
Here's the
yeah.
only point: what's legal in life is not legal in sports. So the people who are going to the gyms and bulking up and looking at Barry Bonds and saying, even if he did, I wouldn't care. They're missing a fundamental point. If your employer says don't do this, if you're playing a game at the will of somebody else and the rules of the game say don't do this, you shouldn't do it. It's simply obeying the law.
Yep. I have to ask Don Catlin, because I know we have to lose you, Dr. Catlin. What about our caller Mark's assertion that the U.S. is simply the most sophisticated user and producer in the world, and so it's all under a cloud? Is that fair?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we're pretty good, let's say, at the side of detection, but also there's some sharp athletes out there. They're not really the athletes. It's their gurus and significant others that are able to negotiate the system. But this is going on worldwide. I don't think it's fair to single out the U.S. It just takes a different form and shape here. But it's a worldwide phenomenon. Africa, it's China, it's
yep.
all over.
But here it comes hitting us just as the Athens Olympics arrive. Don Catlin, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Sure.
We are talking about the doping scandal shadowing America's upcoming Athens Olympic performance. Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about doping in America and the Olympics coming up in Athens. You can join our conversation tonight. Why are this number of America's top athletes turning to drugs? Will the celebration of the Athens Games be dampened by the drug news? And is it possible to keep drugs out of sport, or have we passed the age of purity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Sean Assell, author and senior writer for ESPN, the magazine. He's been covering the track and field steroid story. joins us from New York. And from Austin, Texas, we're joined by John Hoberman, author of Mortal Engines, The Science of Performance and Dehumanization of Sport, author also of Darwin's Athletes, and the upcoming book, Testosterone Dreams. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Sean, we read about something called Project World Record that was built around, at least the papers coming out of Balco indicate, sprinter Tim Montgomery in advance of him breaking the world 100-meter record in 2002. What was that?
Yeah, I mean, that was the subject of my my current piece in ESPN, the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Montgomery is in some ways a real microcosm of what we're talking about. In 2000, he's beyond his early youthful splash that he made. He's had some, his world record has begun to plummet. He's begun to hang around with a fast moving crowd. A friend of his is gunned down in some drug related, shooting. And he needs to turn his life around. He moves to Raleigh. He takes up with Marion Jones' coach. It still doesn't work. In the 2000 Olympics, he doesn't make any of the marquee events.
Right.
And so in October, November of 2000, he's facing a choice. What do I do? And where does he find himself? He finds himself in the offices of Balco in San Francisco, where Victor Conti, as we report, has agreed to create a Project World Record with the sort of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen around him, with the idea of capturing that record. And then involved is Charlie Francis, who was Ben Johnson's coach during the 1988 steroid scandal, Milos the Brain Sarkev, a bodybuilder with a degree in biochemistry, and Victor, and you know, they map out a plan. And as we're told, Victor's central ingredient in that plan was the steroid THG. Within 2 years of that meeting, Tim Montgomery has gone from ninth in the world to first and then set the world record.
And looking back, is it clear? Has he conceded? Or what do we actually know?
Well, he has not commented on our report, but I am confident that my sources are accurate in what they say, and I am confident that, in fact, he did take the designer steroid THG, and that designer steroid was responsible for him going from ninth in the world to first in the world. I have no doubt in my mind about that.
And boom, there's a record, and he holds it. Sue is calling from Merrimack, New Hampshire. Hi, Sue, you're on the air.
Hi. I hope you can hear me okay with my cell phone.
Just fine, thanks.
Two comments. The first is that I really see a lot of this as just a reflection of, and I've said I feel kind of conservative saying this, but really a reflection of the lack of morals and ethics is kind of running rampant in our society, and it's not that different from the crackdown on corporations such as Enron and all of those. And the second thing is the gentleman had spoken about the status we put on athletes, and I've always had a hard time with the amount of money that athletes are paid, the amount of status that they get. Not that I don't respect physical education and all that, but where does, you know, there's a big difference between someone who, you know, goes to school to become a teacher or many other really honorary careers versus someone who's blessed with strong arms. And so,
Strong and maybe enhanced strong arms.
Exactly. And to me, you know, I've had a problem with us looking to athletes with the kind of godlike status that they have. I would love to be a daycare teacher. I'm not going to be because I, quite frankly, can't afford to be. And I've always had a problem with that.
Well, a couple of drugs, maybe you can be an Olympic sprinter, Sue. I'm kidding, but thanks for your call. Let us pick that up. John Hoberman, let me put it to you. What about the way we see athletes? You're suggesting, as I hear you, that we rethink our whole outlook on athletes. Sue raises the moral lens again on the athlete and says she sees part of a kind of moral erosion here. Are you saying that we should just surrender that way of looking at athletes, concede that they're going to be in this kind of biotech era, they're going to be enhanced by drugs and just let the road lead where it may?
Well, which athletes are we talking about?
I mean, we're talking about Olympic level, professional level.
Maybe we should see other athletes who are not willing to pull out all the stops in order to make it to the spotlight and to the big money and to the Olympic Games. I mean, it reminds me of the whole question of, did soccer ever come to America? Well, as a soccer parent, I can assure you soccer has come big time to America. It just hasn't made it the way Major League Baseball has. It depends on what you want out of sport. And one of the virtues of the Balco scandal is it's one of these rare occasions where society at large is really confronted with some very basic questions about what do we want and expect out of sports.
Well, don't we really want the very best performance that the human body can, unenhanced, deliver?
That may be what we want, but we are several decades too late. The doping epidemic of the past 30 to 40 years is a coping strategy to deal with the limitations of the human organism.
But why coping? I mean, why aren't those limitations just the thing that determines what the records are?
Because we know, for example, that the Ben Johnson 9.79 second record set in 1988 was a literally inhuman performance. He was a kind of a Frankensteinian monster. If Mr. Assail is right, the Tim Montgomery Project was, in effect, a second experiment of this kind that resulted in a world record 1/100th of a second faster than that of Ben Johnson, but equally artificial. It's time for especially public officials and politicians who like athletes to win gold medals at Olympic Games to understand that Olympic sport, the elite sport that you're addressing, has been, since the 1890s, an enormous biological experiment carried out on the human organism.
So you're saying if we want to look at it even now as a kind of moral gloss, it's already a mockery. It's been a mockery of that for a long time.
I'm saying that it's time for us to recognize that the human organism has limits, and that if, for example, in this case, an American shot putter like Kevin Toth throws 74 feet 4 inches, as he did a year ago at the Kansas Relays, it's time to send in the scientists and ask how in the world did he manage the longest throw in the world for 13 years.
And now he, of course, is on the Balco list.
I was not surprised to see that he tested positive for the designer steroid THG.
But are you saying we just accept this then and may the best Frankenstein win?
No, I'm saying just the opposite. I'm saying that it is time to understand the difference between human and pharmacologically boosted inhuman performances and not base, for example, a track and field culture that sells many tickets in Europe on the Grand Prix circuit. People are going to have to get used to not expecting much in the way of world records.
Oh, you mean
drug-free sports?
So take the drugs out, but also understand that it won't be a steady progression toward faster and faster times. It will ebb and flow.
The demand for linear progression of faster and faster times and longer distances is the proximate cause of the drug crisis of the past 30 to 40 years.
Sean Assail, is that ever going to happen, given where we are now, given all the expectations built up around high-level sport?
Well, I mean, I think it can, and I agree with Mr. Hoberman completely. I think that a virtue of this Balco case is that it forces us to ask ourselves as sports fans, well, you know, what do we want? Are we willing to compromise morally to see, you know, greater and greater and greater records? I mean, I think we have to look at ourselves with respect to Barry Bonds. I mean, without assessing guilt, even the question of guilt, you know, do most baseball fans are rooting for him still, completely ignoring much of what's swirling around him.
So even if we decide that we don't want that path anymore, can the cork be put back in this bottle?
Oh, surely. I mean, surely, if we decide and the political pressure is brought on Major League Baseball or on football, sure, the mechanisms exist. I mean, you know, Victor Conti is I don't believe, one of very, very many. I mean, I think you can put, to some extent, the cork back in the bottle.
Well,
or at least create a vigilant police force that causes deterrence. You know, steroids were rife in football 15 years ago. I'm not saying that they're out of football, but I'm saying that you know, football's incredible drug testing policy has helped.
Well, this may be the summer that brings it to a head with the Athens Olympics looming right in front of us. It's been great having both of you tonight. Sean Assail, senior writer for ESPN the magazine, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
And John Hoberman in Austin, Texas, author of Darwin's Athletes and the Upcoming Testosterone Dreams, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, the nation's final farewell to Ronald Reagan. This is On Point. The nation said its formal goodbye to President Ronald Reagan today in a poignant, pageantry-filled funeral at Washington's National Cathedral. Both President Bushes were in attendance, along with Presidents Ford, Carter, and Clinton, and their wives. Former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev was there, along with Britain's Margaret Thatcher and King Abdullah of Jordan. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor read John Winthrop's 1630 sermon that inspired Mr. Reagan's description of America as a shining city upon a hill. The final eulogy was read by President George W. Bush. Ronald Reagan belongs to the ages now, but we preferred it when he belonged to us, the president told those gathered. Here is an excerpt from the president's eulogy.
Ronald Reagan carried himself, even in the most powerful office, with a decency and attention to small kindnesses that also define a good life. He was a courtly, gentle, and considerate man, never known to slight or embarrass others. Many people across the country cherish letters he wrote in his own hand to family members on important occasions, to old friends dealing with sickness and loss, to strangers with questions about his days in Hollywood. Boy once wrote to him requesting federal assistance to help clean up his bedroom. The president replied that unfortunately funds are dangerously low. He continued, I'm sure your mother was fully justified in proclaiming your room a disaster. Therefore, you are in an excellent position to launch another volunteer program in our nation. Congratulations. See, our 40th president wore his title lightly, and it fit like a white Stetson. In the end, through his belief in our country and his love for our country, he became an enduring symbol of our country. We think of the steady stride, that tilt of the head and snap of the salute, the big screen smile, and the glint in his Irish eyes when a story came to mind. We think of a man advancing in years with the sweetness and sincerity of a scout saying the pledge. We think of that grave expression that sometimes came over his face, the seriousness of a man angered by injustice and frightened by nothing. We know, as he always said, that America's best days are ahead of us. But with Ronald Reagan's passing, some very fine days are behind us, and that is worth our tears. Americans saw death approach Ronald Reagan twice, in a moment of violence, and then in the years of departing light. He met both with courage and grace. In these trials, he showed how a man so enchanted by life can be at peace with life's end. And where does that strength come from? Where is that courage learned? It is the faith of a boy who read the Bible with his mom. It is the faith of a man lying in an operating room who prayed for the one who shot him before he prayed for himself. It is the faith of a man with a fearful illness who waited on the Lord to call him home. Now, death has done all that death can do. And as Ronald Wilson Reagan goes his way, we are left with the joyful hope he shared.
President George W. Bush eulogizing former President Ronald Reagan earlier today at the National Cathedral in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.